Okay. Where are we? Where were we last time? Where? I guess I began with this fundamental question. It's kind of an observation. You have the peace settlement that was imposed on Germany at the end of the First World War, a peace settlement embodied in the Treaty of Versailles of June 1919, imposed on Germany, pretty much forced to sign it. Thank you. That's the only great peace settlement in the modern history of great power politics to be imposed by the Western democracies, the three great Western democracies, Great Britain, France, and the United States, and by them alone, right? It wasn't as though Russia was still an ally. Russia had dropped out of the war as a result of the Bolshevik Revolution in November 1917, right? It's not like the arrangements that took shape after World War II, in which the Soviet Union was an equal party, right? It's not like the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, you know, which is basically fashioned by conservative forces in Europe. Right? This was imposed by the democracies, the only great political settlement that has that distinction, right? On the other hand, it's also turned out to be the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics, modern history of great power politics. You know, just barely a decade later, as we'll see, the whole thing's in a shambles. You know, exactly 20 years later, a new and more dangerous war with Germany breaks out. You know, dramatic failure. And the puzzle, the question for you is there any connection between those two things? Right? A more basic question is there something fundamentally wrong with the way democracies conduct their foreign policy? Is there something distinctive about the way democracies conduct their foreign policy that leads to these kinds of problems? You know, and that's a fundamental policy issue. It's of absolutely transcendent importance when you're grappling with these issues of war and peace. You know, what sort of policy should you pursue? What sort of policy should a democratic state pursue? And you know, you think, well, the answer is obvious. In international politics, as in ordinary life, you should always try and do the right thing. You know, you should conduct yourself in conformity with principles of justice, fairness, equity. You know, you shouldn't, mistreat your former adversary. You should aim at rebuilding fences with him by basing the settlement on these kind of fundamental abstract principles, which correspond to the, you know, deepest cravings of the entire human race. You know, it's like a world where there's no threat of war, a world where everyone feels secure, a world where all the states are that compose the system have, you know, believe in the rule of law, believe in democracy, you know, embody those kind of fundamental liberal values. That's what we want. The war of the First World War was a war, Wilson said, to make the world safe for democracy. We want to, you know, encourage the spread of our own principles. Right? How could you argue with that? How could you argue with the notion that it's a mistake to want to do the right thing, to base the international order on certain principles of justice? It's thus quite striking that there is an alternate way of looking at these things, a way of looking at these things that rose in reaction to the Wilson policy and especially to the sort of instability that people like George Kennan, for example, thought that the Wilson policy had introduced into the structure of world politics. You know, and That's why I wanted you to read that Canon article. Read it, you know, as many times as you have to. It's a short article, in order to kind of absorb that sort of thinking. That critique of Wilsonianism is counterintuitive, precisely because so many of us have absorbed the basic Wilsonian philosophy, in, you know, just in the course of growing up in this country. The whole notion that power does not have a legitimate role to play in international politics, the considerations of justice are not all that clear-cut, and you have to kind of, you can't think in absolutist terms, in terms of, you know, just moral principle without, you know, just ignoring, you know, what, you know, the whole question of what makes for stable structure of power. You know, that whole realist critique, a critique that's relatively amoral, that criticizes Wilsonianism for being, you know, too focused on moral considerations and too neglectful of kind of power political considerations. It's a powerful critique, especially given what happened. And so you have to ask yourself, is that critique correct, or is the Wilson philosophy basically the way to go? Maybe he made some mistakes, but basically that's the kind of a fundamental framework in which we should approach these kind of core political issues. How do you get at that issue? And as I said in the first class, and I hope everyone understands what I mean by this, far more important than the substantive issues that we're going to be concerned with in this class, and those issues I think are very important, but more important still is the whole question of how do you get at those problems? How do you figure out, to your own satisfaction, what the answer should be? And the point is, there's a method for doing that. You take these great issues, the whole question of realism, the whole question of Wilsonianism, how should foreign policy be conducted, and so on. It's very hard to attack those issues at a purely abstract level. You need some way of kind of bringing them down to earth to make them studyable so that you can see beyond your own preconceptions. And how do you do that? You look at the discussions of these issues and you see how the proponents of each of these different points of view try to substantiate their arguments. What sort of evidence do they give to convince you that their way of looking at these things is in fact correct? And they have to kind of give you empirical examples because they want to show you that these ideas are not just these kind of disembodied abstractions, but they have real-world relevance. Okay, in this particular case, these arguments about general principles are supported by particular historical interpretations. As a matter of fact, they kind of translate into historical interpretations. Right? There's this whole Wilsonian theory of what happened after World War I. This is a theory, oh yeah, this was an unstable peace, but it wasn't Wilson's fault. He wanted to do the right thing, but he was kind of outmaneuvered, outmanipulated by these kind of devious Europeans. You know, they got Wilson to kind of go along with a peace settlement that was the opposite of what Wilson in his heart really wanted. Wilson was still the Wilson of the Peace Without Victory speech of January 1917 in his heart. He wanted a peace of reconciliation. He wanted a moderate peace. But these Europeans, they didn't think in those terms. They thought in these kind of power political terms, and they managed to kind of sabotage the Wilson program, right? The Europeans, especially the French, British kind of halfway between the French and the Americans, according to this conception, the French, they wanted to crush Germany. You know, they wanted to kind of keep Germany from ever posing a threat to them again, and that meant, you know, a very vindictive, vengeful, harsh peace that ran totally counter to what Wilson wanted, right? Now, that's a very common view. I'd be surprised if there's a single person in this classroom who hasn't been exposed to that view, like in high school textbooks or whatever. What do What this means for our purposes is that we can get at the kind of general abstract question of how foreign policy should be conducted by examining that particular historical interpretation of what happened at Paris, Paris Peace Conference, in 1919. Okay. And in doing this analysis, we conducted it last time at the general level, what was Wilson's general conception of how peace should be conducted, what was the general conception of the French. And at that general level, we reached a kind of important conclusion. The general level was Wilson thought not in terms of reconciliation, but in terms of justice. But justice meant punishing the criminal state. If you believe in the law, the rule of law, well, you have to punish the country that violated the law. That was Germany, obviously. But I should say, one of the things that's kind of was very surprising to me when I first started studying this stuff is how uncritically Wilson took the view that Germany had been the party that was responsible for the war. Germany was the great aggressor. It's like Wilson, he's a political scientist. He's the only American president to have a PhD, only professor. And you think that someone like that would have said, well, we don't really know what caused the war until we get the documents, until we see what was inside the minds of these people at the time. And it's much too early to make these kind of hard and fast judgments. But Wilson was convinced Germany had caused the war, that justice meant that the aggressor had to be punished, right? We saw that at the abstract level. Whereas for the French, they took a much more jaded view. It's like, well, this whole notion of abstract principles of justice, it's somewhat problematic. Actually, someone in this class made this argument last time. It's somewhat problematic because every country has its own idea of what's just. The world is not shaped by divine decree, it's shaped by centuries of struggle, by power, and so on. So who's to say in some absolute way, what's right and what's wrong? And that means that power considerations have to be taken into account because countries are going to differ about all these things. And the crucial thing is Germany's a very strong country inherently, stronger than France. In order to kind of provide for French security in such a world, you needed to create a structure of power where Germany would be kept in line. And that meant the maintenance of the bloc, the war that had taken shape during the war, the bloc of the three great Western democracies. Keep those American troops in Europe, right? American power should be a normal, integral part of European political life. Right? This is not the Wilson conception. All right. So you have, at that general level, ideas which are somewhat at variance with the received wisdom about Woodrow Wilson and about the Paris Peace Conference and so on. But in keeping with the general approach we're taking in this course, we don't want to just limit ourselves to abstract, general statements of what policy should be. We want to look at the nuts and bolts. We want to go down yet another layer of concrete and so look at how the actual terms of peace were fashioned and what thoughts were in people's minds when they made the decisions to opt for this type of arrangement as opposed to that. And you can do this. The negotiations at Paris are extremely well documented. We have British records, French records, American records of all sorts dealing with these things, all very easily accessible. All right? And so by examining the negotiations at Paris, number one, to see whether in effect this was a struggle between the conciliatory Americans, whatever Wilson's basic rhetoric was, but in practice, conciliatory, moderate, versus the harsh French, looking to see whether that negotiations support that picture. That's one great test. And the other great test has to do with the nature of the final settlement. Was the final settlement in line with Wilson's basic thinking? Did it represent the triumph of Wilson in the peace negotiations or his defeat? So we were applying those two tests. And by bringing the issue down to earth like this, we're taking these very general issues and showing how they turn on very concrete matters. But when something is concrete, when the claims are concrete, they become studyable in the light of the evidence, answerable. And the answers we reach, having set the whole problem up in this way, will automatically tell you something about these very general issues that we start out with. You know, it's a very powerful method for getting at these things and kind of liberating yourself from this whole web of preconceptions. You know, you're basically programmed into believing what you're told, you know, from the first day of kindergarten on. You know, and one of the main things you want to kind of get in college is a sense that you don't have to just believe what people tell you. You know, there's a way of assessing whether those beliefs are to be taken at face value, those claims are to be taken at face value, a way of making up your mind for yourself. And you want to kind of get a feel for what that method is in the course of this sort. So that's what we're going to do today, right? Looking at the concrete issues that were negotiated at Paris with these two fundamental questions in mind. You know, when you look at the negotiations themselves, is it basically a struggle between Wilson and the French, Americans being moderate, the French being harsh? And second, when you look at the final settlement in light of those negotiations, did this represent the triumph of Wilson or his defeat? You know, was it in line with the basic Wilson philosophy or not? Okay, and so with that as a preface, we're now in a position to kind of look at the issues. We're going to start with the territorial issues and then look at the non-territorial issues. And the territorial issues themselves can be broken down into two parts, those having to do with Germany's western borders and those having to do with Germany's eastern borders. What do you find when you do this analysis? Well, with regard to Germany's western borders, this is one area where there's significant support for the traditional view that the French wanted to impose, at the very least, a special status on the Rhineland, right? On this whole area in western Germany, the left bank of the Rhine between the Rhine River and the French and Belgian borders, and a little strip on the right bank of the Rhine as well. Not necessarily to split off the Rhineland from Germany and make it a separate state, although there were people in France who were thinking those terms. But special status, you know, maybe autonomy for the Rhineland within Germany. And this was opposed mainly by the British, but also by Wilson. And the French backed off, and a compromise was worked out. What are the terms of the compromise? The Rhineland would have a special status, although it would remain an integral part of Germany. It would have a special military status. It would be demilitarized. The Germans wouldn't be allowed to station troops there or build fortifications there, right, for an indefinite period. Plus, for a 15-year period, assuming Germany complied with the treaty, Allied troops, not just French troops. The French didn't want this just for themselves. They wanted the British and the Americans by their side. Allied troops would be stationed in the Rhineland. There would be three zones. Assuming Germany complied with the treaty, the first zone in the north would be evacuated after 5 years, the second zone after 10, the third after 15. But when the occupation ended, say 1934, 35, whenever, that didn't mean that the Germans could send their troops back in. The Rhineland was to be demilitarized so as to help alleviate the military threat that Germany would pose to France. Right. Okay. Did Wilson have any... another thing. There was also to be a treaty of guarantee that was given to France against German aggression. You see, France, even though France was the victor power, the French were already quite worried about the possibility of a resurgence of German power. Germany is inherently a stronger country than France. So the French are looking for these guarantees. And they get this treaty of guarantee from the British and the Americans against German aggression. And the British guarantee would only take effect if the American one does. As it turned out, when the Senate defeated the Treaty of Versailles, refused to ratify it, the treaties of guarantee went down the tubes as well. And when the American treaty went down the tubes, so did the British. So the French basically, the French weren't given anything at all on that score. Is this at variance with the basic Wilson philosophy? No. The final arrangement, very much in line with what he wanted. The whole idea that there should be constraints on German power that didn't apply to France, especially for a provisional period, no problem with, given his whole notion of who would cause the war. Right? The Germans should not be given equal political rights, according to Wilson. Why not? Because they had to first make amends for their crimes. They had to be subjected to what Wilson called a generation of thoughtfulness, where they would have to reflect on the crimes that they had committed, and undergo a period of penance, make amends for those crimes. Hence, you know, 15-year period for the occupation, that made sense from the standpoint of this philosophy. Keeping the Germans out of the League of Nations for the time being, that made sense. You wanted to kind of stigmatize the Germans to a certain extent, say, you had caused this war, you had committed this great crime, now you got to work your way back into the community of civilized nations by accepting your responsibility, making amends for your crime, accepting, you know, an inferior political status. Provisions relating to the Rhineland are of a piece with that. What about the eastern border? So you can see from the map here. Remember the pre-war map and how Eastern Europe was divided between the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, and the Russian Empire? That's totally transformed. All these little states now come into being in the borderlands between Germany and Russia. Austrian Empire falls apart, which, by the way, was more extreme than what Wilson called for in the 14 points. He just called for autonomy for, like, you know, the Czechs and the Southern Slavs and so on. But now they were given states of their own in Austria. Not a big problem for anybody. Poland was a different issue. You recall one of the 14 points called for the reestablishment of independent Poland with secure access to the sea. Well, secure access to the sea meant that the Vistula River, the valley of the Vistula River, would go to Poland. The problem was that this whole area, which had been pre-war German territory, this is inhabited by people who were kind of ethnically related to the Poles, but they had come to think of themselves as Germans, a lot of them. And some of this area, like the city of Danzig at the mouth of the Vistula River, was a German city, you know, 99% German. Were you going to give this to Poland? Well, the negotiations about these Polish issues, the whole issue of what came to be called the Polish Corridor, giving Poland this kind of chunk of pre-war German territory along the banks of the Vistula. And also there's another issue of Upper Silesia. Upper Silesia is the second most important concentration of heavy industry in Germany after the Ruhr in Western Germany. Upper Silesia is this area over here. And again, a lot of its inhabitants were Poles, but having lived in Germany, they had come to think of themselves as Germans. The Poles said, well, the Germans had 200 years to brainwash them to thinking of themselves as Germans. We should be given a certain amount of time to brainwash them back into thinking of themselves as Poles. The Poles said, well, we need Upper Silesia because we need an industrial base for our economy. And we can make this claim about the ethnic composition of the population there, all right? So you have these debates about the Polish corridor and about Upper Silesia. In those debates, did you find Wilson championing the idea of a relatively moderate solution, friendly to the Germans, leery of giving too much for the Poles for fear of alienating the Germans, with the French taking a pro-Polish line and the British halfway in between? No, that's not what you find at all. You find Wilson being quite pro-Polish, and Wilson and the French taking a very pro-Polish line, whereas the British take a pro-German line in this. They don't think the Poles are politically mature enough to treat the German minority the way it needs to be treated, and they anticipate all kinds of problems for putting Germans, or people who thought of themselves as Germans, under the rule of the Poles. And again, they work out a compromise. It's to be a plebiscite in Upper Silesia in 1921 under the auspices of the League of Nations. And as for the city of Danzig, they make this a free city, under the auspices of the League of Nations, not part of Germany or part of Poland. But basically, they give Poland the corridor, and then as a result of the 1921 plebiscite, Poland gets a nice chunk of Upper Silesia as well. Out of line with the basic Wilson philosophy? No, very much in line with his philosophy. The negotiations show Wilson as sympathetic to the Poles, right, and hostile to the Germans. What else in the East? The Austrians want to become part of Germany. After the Habsburg monarchy falls apart, there's a rump state called German Austria. It's basically the same as present-day Austria. And the Austrians, they feel like their new country is not economically viable. I mean, you have this huge metropolis, Vienna, suitable as the main city in a vast multinational empire, but kind of this huge disproportion between this great city of Vienna and a small hinterland of German Austria. The Austrians want to become part of Germany. All three of the allies say, no, we're not going to sanction that, because that would result in too great an increase in German population and thus in German power. No one has any problems with ruling the South. Okay. But Poland is the main thing here on the territorial side. What about the non-territorial issues? War criminals and the War Guilt Clause. There have been crimes committed during the war, atrocities of various sorts. Although, frankly, from the German point of view, the claim was that the Allies also committed atrocities. Yes? The Allies said no to what? To the German Austria? Because it would make Germany too strong. Giving Germany another 10 million people is basically, Germany already has like 60 million to 40 million in France. You're going to make it 70 to 40, 2 to 1 practically? No, you don't want to do that. And then not a violation of the principle of self-determination to ask Austria to remain independent. This is Wilson's thing, right? The point is, he had no problem with this. The Wilson philosophy is not a philosophy of absolute self-determination and damn the consequences. You saw that when we were talking about his whole way of dealing with how Germany's colonial possessions were to be divided up, right? The interests of the indigenous population, well, weren't ignored, equal weight with those of the imperial powers. This is not our current conception of self-determination by any means. Okay. War criminals. Yeah, well, as I say, the Allies, according to the Germans, had committed war crimes as well, violations of the rule of law in instituting what the Germans called the hunger blockade of the Central Powers during the war. So it wasn't supposed to be permissible under the traditional rules of law, and there was, significant hunger within within Germany. But, it's like our German argument is this is victor's justice. This is one of the things that undermined the settlement. the Allies had these provisions for trying these German war criminals, up to and including the Kaiser, who they couldn't get their hands on because he'd taken refuge in Holland. But this was Wilson against this? No, it's this basic principle. You believe in the rule of law, how can you allow the lawbreakers to go off scot-free? Of course they should be punished. Of course they should. There should be courts and trials of war criminals. Similarly, Article 231 of the Treaty of Versailles, famous war guilt clause it was called, where Germany was obliged to accept responsibility for causing the war. No one, not Wilson, not Lloyd George, not Clemenceau, no one had any problem with the war guilt clause. It was the most obvious thing in the world to these people that Germany had caused the war and should take responsibility for it. What about the disarmament provisions of the treaty? Germany was disarmed. You know, no air force, no navy to speak of. Small 100,000 man army. All these provisions for Germany to dismantle fortresses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Was this imposed on Wilson by the Europeans? Did Wilson want to treat Germany gently in this area and allow Germany to have a significant army? No. But that what they did as a way of kind of catering to the Wilson philosophy was they introduced the disarmament provisions of the treaty with a clause saying that the disarmament of Germany would take place in order to render possible an eventual, you know, total disarmament of the major powers. You know? And you recall one of the 14 points had a provision about the reduction of arms down to whatever level is consistent with national safety. Right. This created problems, this attempt to accommodate the Wilson philosophy, when the Allies wouldn't disarm, when the French and the British didn't disarm after the war, because the Germans said, we signed this with the promise that this would make general disarm possible, and look at how they were reneging that promise. What hypocrites they are. Who was responsible for the disarmament provisions? The French had wanted to allow Germany to keep a 200,000 man army, an army recruited on the basis of conscription from the society as a whole. The French believe in conscription because they think it prevents the army from becoming a state within a state and makes the army the representative of the nation as a whole. The British have a very different view about conscription. And they think of conscription as forcing people to bear arms and so on as an infringement of liberty and so the British said instead of a 200,000 man army based on conscription, a 100,000 man army based on long term recruits, people who enlist in the army for a longer period, making it more kind of a state within a state. And it was the British, not the French, who got their way. League of Nations, it's Wilson's great dream. League of Nations, he opposed the British conception of the League of Nations because, yes? Yes. I said disagreement between France and Britain regarding the German army. Okay? The British idea. The French were defeated.
Did Wilson have a point of view on that?
He basically sided with the British. And don't forget, the French have this philosophy of compromise because your main goal is to maintain unity among the three Western powers. Okay, League of Nations. Wilson insisted on what was to become Article 10 of the League. This is the article that obliged the members of the League to respect and preserve as against external aggression the territorial integrity and existing political independence of all members of the League. This is the, their independence, their territorial integrity is being guaranteed. The British wanted something softer and looser that wasn't as binding. Very, very similar to the attitude of the U.S. Senate. And Wilson rejected that British concept because it said, well, it would simply make the League into an influential debating society. The League needed teeth. Article 10 was crucial to the whole concept of collective security. They got his way on that. On the other hand, when the French said that if you're serious about the League needing teeth, the League would need to control some sort of military force based on national contingents, you know, some kind of international army, you know, so that if there were threats to the security of members of the League would be able to do something about it. Wilson dead set against this. He said that would be tantamount to substituting international militarism for national militarism. See, the whole notion that force is a normal and natural part of international political life, and once you kind of suppress the use of force, you're just kind of asking for trouble, that notion is absolutely foreign to Wilson. Rule out the use of force. And Wilson, again, got his way on the issue of the League, which, after all, was his baby. Okay, now we come to the reparations, which in a sense, this is very important because the whole struggle over the Versailles system was fought out over the issue of the reparations in the post-war period. And the account of what happened at Paris and the discussions on reparations forms a key, integral part of this kind of Wilsonian theory of the failure of the peace. The argument is that the French wanted to crush Germany by insisting on absolutely impossible reparations. Indemnity, reparations, it would be so huge, obviously the Germans couldn't pay, and this would give France an excuse to kind of go on intervening in Germany, using force against Germany and so on. Whereas the Anglo-Saxons, especially the Americans, took a very, much more moderate line, but they had to kind of give way in the face of French intransigence. An important theory. Is it valid? Okay. I should say this is what I did my dissertation on, and all this stuff was like just utter shock to me at the time. Because the truth is almost exactly the reverse of what we have been led to believe. What did the French want in terms of reparations? Initially, not very much. Their whole notion, the war had been fought in northern France. Germany had not been touched by the war. Who's going to pay for the restoration of the devastated areas in northern France? The French wanted to maintain the economic union which had developed in the last year of the war. And basically drew on the resources of her great allies, the British and the Americans, invoking the principle of equality and community of sacrifice. If this was a joint struggle, the burdens of the struggle should be shared equitably, right? And that meant that France shouldn't have to pay for the restoration of the devastated areas all by herself. The arrangements which had come into being during the war providing for economic support of France, ultimately from the Americans, were the key to the solution. They didn't want to draw on all these German goodies. This is of a piece with Clemenceau's basic philosophy about maintaining the wartime alliance. Problem was, Wilson wasn't willing to go along with any of this stuff. U.S. policy after World War I on these economic matters, on the whole issue of Reconstruction, is 180 degrees different from what it would be after World War II. There's no Marshall Plan after World War I. In fact, Wilson, again, this is this kind of moralistic view of it's like, it's like, how dare the French expect us to give them even more? They should be grateful for what they've gotten from us so far. Like, as soon as the war is over, You know, they dismantle the whole system of economic controls that had taken shape during the war, which was used to kind of funnel support to the Europeans, especially to the French. See, we threw the harness off, Wilson says, November 1918. You see, Americans unwilling to give anything more than they have already given. Not even willing to kind of, you know, cancel the inter-allied debts that had been run up during the war. Right? Again, they're not framing policy with a view to the future of what will create a stable international order. They're thinking in more, you know, these kind of moral terms of just who should be responsible. Not us. We didn't cause the war. Why should we have to pay? Right? That kind of philosophy. And the French found it hard to accept this American refusal. And initially they used the reparations as a lever. Say, well, if you're unwilling to give us what we need, we're going to be forced to ask for these impossible reparations from Germany. And they gave these very high figures. But then when it became clear that that tactic wasn't working and the Americans remained intransigent, the French basically changed their tune and stated their real goals. And their real goals were far more moderate than what the British were insisting on. Maybe a quarter of what the British were insisting on. You know, $30 billion, which the Germans would pay off over a period of 42 years at 5% interest. And that would amount to something like 6% of German national income. You know, significant but not impossible. And it was very much in line with what the American experts wanted as a figure for the German reparations. Okay. But they couldn't reach an agreement because the British insisted on a whole lot more. Right? And at one point, the French were even more moderate than the Americans. This was in response to this British intransigence. The French said, well, look, we're willing to go back even further and insist on a strict reading of the 14 points, ruling out pretty much anything the British would get because it limited reparations to compensation for damage done to the civilian property of the Allies. And this was mostly northern France. Very little civilian damage was done to the British. And that the French calculated would have resulted in, you know, maybe $20 billion, not even $30 billion as a reparation bill. You know, 4% of German national income, something like that. And Wilson, you know, faced with the opportunity of siding with the French, sided with the British. And again, you can see how moral considerations affected his decision here. Because what was his rationale for siding with the British? The British argument was, it's unfair for the French to kind of get compensation for all this damage done to mere property. It says the British deserve compensation done to their civilian population in the form of actual physical harm. They wanted to include pensions and separation allowances for their soldiers who were killed during the war or injured during the war, and so on. Human claims should come before property claims. And Wilson was told by his advisors that, no, you can't do that. That's a violation of the 14 points. The same logic which ruled out charging Germany for the entire cost of the war, with the argument that the civilian taxpayers would have to pay the cost of the war, so this was a civilian damage. They said that same logic should also rule out the inclusion of pensions. And you know what Wilson's response to this was? He says, he has this meeting with his advisors, and he says, logic, I don't give a damn about logic. I'm going to include pensions. So he basically sided with the British against the French. Now, one more interesting thing that emerged from the documents about all this stuff is when the French basically see that their Anglo-Saxon partners are turning their backs on them, how do they respond? By opting for a very harsh line toward Germany? No, the surprising thing is they make all these overtures to the Germans in the middle of peace conferences about let's get together, let's form an entente, let's have a continental entente. The same sort of thing you're going to see after World War II. You know, the whole notion of the continental West Europeans coming together based on a Franco-German Entente with a kind of anti-Anglo-Saxon, anti-British, anti-American edge to it. This you already see in 1919. Quite extraordinary, given what the French had just gone through for war, reaching out to the Germans that way. Okay, again, this is important because it shows you the kinds of considerations that affect international politics. What do I have? About 1 more minute. The kinds of considerations that affect international politics. Why is France behaving this way, more moderate than the Anglo-Saxons, less moralistic, more jaded? It's not because France has deeper democratic values than Britain and America. It's because France's geographical position is totally different. Her power political position is totally different. The Americans, with this huge economy that dwarfs that of any other country in the world, with weak neighbors in the north and south, these huge oceans to the east and west, they don't have to worry about power politics. They can indulge themselves in all this moralism. France is stuck there on the continent of Europe with this powerful, you know, Germany right next door. The French have to think in power political terms. That's the thing. All right. The last point is the effect of the Wilson policy on the system. On the one hand, you have this punitive policy. The Germans are going to be punished. This is bound to provoke German resistance. On the other hand, the Germans are, there's no way of keeping the Germans in line. What could be worse? You guarantee resistance, you have no way of dealing with it. It's bound to lead to problems, right? And those problems, well, that's what we're going to be analyzing when we get back from the break. So have a nice holiday, and I'll see you in class on Wednesday.